and on top of that, medium machine gun officers, because we're given the basic infantry officers course and then the machine gun course superimposed on top of it.
Yeah, very little time.
Very little time for la vie sociale. Mm-hmm. But, once again, I worked for some darn decent fellows. I mentioned earlier on the Colonel D. Stuart Forbes, but Ronnie Jack was my major. He was in charge of the officer training wing there, and he was a great lad, and he used to take his young officers on picnics up in the top of the mountains around Valcarce, and he'd have weekends for us in Trois-Rivières, where we'd take some rooms down at the Chateau de Bois, which was the big hotel, the only first-class hotel, I guess, in Trois-Rivières in those days, and we had some interesting evenings. We had some mess nights in the mess. We had a nice mess in Trois-Rivières, not so much in Valcarce because it was in a tent, but we had some guest nights. We had people in. I remember having Monsieur Maurice Duplessis in for dinner in Trois-Rivières. That's where he came from, you know, and he came and dined with us in the machine gun training center. And we got dickied up. We didn't have dress uniforms, and nobody was allowed to wear their mess kits, although some of the old people did, you know. But there was a prohibition against it in those days. Everybody was supposed to wear their...
So that would not make others feel obligated
exactly
to purchase.
Exactly. I think that was a reason. I certainly wasn't high enough up in the areas of power then to find out why, but I'm sure that must have been the reason.
Morris came to one of your...
I guess indeed. And he was very kind to us generally, because earlier on I was saying how they opened the doors for us to go to curling clubs and golf clubs and so forth. He certainly did that in Trois-Rivières. We were persona grata everywhere because of...
But Morris Duplessis, it was ever a friend of the...
Maurice Duplessis was an opportunist of the First Order and a consummate politician. And we were bringing into Trois-Rivières and his constituency more money than they'd ever seen before. All they had was paper mills, smelly old paper mills, and here we had Cotto Barracks with thousands of troops.
Spending money.
Well, of course. Maybe that's unfair, but...
Well, what was the attitude? I find this interesting that you meet Duplessis. What was the attitude of the... of everyone else? I mean, he'd been bad-mouthed since day one.
I don't know. We didn't seem, you know, I may be...
Apolitical, so apolitical.
Yeah, exactly. Terribly apolitical. And Duplessis was nice to us, and I remember having, in the town hall, he had a reception for all the officers once, and because I was one of the few bilingual officers there, I was asked to thank him on behalf of the officers' mess at Cotto Barracks. And I remember calling him Maurice the Magnificent, you know, for this wonderful banquet he'd given. And after, he kidded me about this. He said, that's a name that will stick with me. I don't know whether it ever did or not, but it was the first time he'd ever heard it.
Now, we're getting ahead here. It's kind of interesting, but now you went, first of all, to Valcarce.
Valcarce.
And now you're under canvas.
Under canvas in Valcarce, yes.
And how did you react to that nonsense after living in the regimental life?
Well, this was really our first living in the field, or for me it was. And I found living in tents not bad. I am a neat and tidy person generally, and I didn't find it difficult to rid up my tent every morning and make it look, pass muster. We trained long hours. My goodness, we're starting 6 o'clock in the morning with the first PT parade, and because I was a physical jerks man, amongst other things, I used to have to take the PT parades for the officers that were undergoing training. So I used to have to be up about 5:30 every morning, and we'd work until, the wee small hours sometimes if we're out in the night scheme. So you didn't have much time to worry about your living conditions. As it got colder, as we got into the fall, and the decision was taken to move from Valcarce to Trois-Rivières, we were mighty happy to go, let me tell you, because tent living, and right in Valcarce, the wind sweeps across there frequently, and lots of sand getting in their lines, in your kit. Of course, you have to lay out your kit every day.
So, did you have a bathroom?
Oh, no, not when you were an officer cadet. No.
Then you went to Three Rivers.
Three Rivers. And I finished my course, both my basic infantry officer's course and my machine gun course at Three Rivers. And the complicated parts of it, the indirect fire and so forth, we're talking about. And I was then immediately grabbed and put on the staff of the Machine Gun Training Center. And I think that if there's any period in my Army life that intensified learning took place, it was when I became an instructor as opposed to when I was being instructed. And the reason for that is that we had these little huts with four people living in them, and I lived with Bill Charman, Jacques Blay, and John Brown.
And these, the
no, these chaps were all sergeant major instructors in the regular Army, SMIs they were called. And they were the people who had been sent from the regular Army to really get the core of the Machine Gun Training Center going. And they'd all been promoted to lieutenants. By this time, I was a second lieutenant. And the four of us lived in one of these huts. And these chaps, I don't know, they must have had at least 25 to 30 years service at that point in time. They were the best instructors I have ever seen. School, university, any place else. They knew their subjects inside out. And as a consequence, I learned more from them. And they were the kind of instructors that did their homework every night. We'd get a little drunk on a Saturday night or something like that. But every night, I learned how an instructor has to go about keeping on top of his class. Not only from the discipline point of view, but from the wiseacre that reads three or four chapters ahead and tries to ask you questions about that. And these three old SMIs, I owe more to them, my knowledge of the military, than any people I could ever think of. And it was during that 5 or 6 month period that I was on the staff of the Machine Gun Training Center that I got the great admiration for the permanent force, the few people that had been in the force before 1939 that had kept the thing going. And boy, they were top notch. I think they all ended up as colonels eventually, but they were just wonderful men, and I learned a great deal.
How do they feel about taking commission after reaching SMI? I mean, sergeant majors.
I don't know enough about the background, but I used to always hear them talk about the pension implications. This is what they were
looking at.
Yeah.
Because
these chaps knew they weren't going overseas. They'd all, I think, all been in World War I, you know.
I see.
And they were looking at the long-term future.
It's just that Sergeant Major is, well, God's right-hand man.
Well, you see, at that center, they had a permanent force Sergeant Major Lou Palacio of the Van Deuxième, an excellent RSM. And they used to find that being a small frog in a big pool was difficult when they left the sergeant's mess where they were the king into the officer's mess.
Yeah.
But these three that I'm talking about, they were still friends with Mr. Palacio, who was our RSM, but it was a hands-off relationship, you know. I never heard of any of them saying, let's drop into the sergeant's mess or anything like that. Oh, that was different. And Mr. Palacio was a wonderful host, and he frequently had the young officers over to the sergeant's mess.
Now, were restricted to your two drinks and out, or type of thing, do you recall?
I can't ever remember anybody in that group that I was with ever drinking a great deal. They're terribly conscientious. Oh, very conscientious, poop. I don't know why, because I have run into some wild people in my day, but that particular group, and I must say that when Mr. Palacio invited us to his mess, we acted as though we were in our own mess. In other words, we behaved ourselves.
Now, the old story is that sergeants know how to live.
They do.
And the officers haven't a clue what it's really about when it comes to fine living.
True.
Is this quite true?
True. We used to like to go to the sergeant's mess because the beer was better and everything else was better. Now, that is quite true. The sergeants have a touch. And, of course, they're in contact with the people who give them the thing. Exactly. They know how to operate. Canadian NCOs are just marvelous. Really, they are. And I found that much later on. 1947, I went up to command Fort Churchill in northern Manitoba, our northern experimental station. The officer's mess was complete shambles. Paddy Fallon was my RSM. Go to the sergeant's mess, you'll think you were in a first-class hotel.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
day and I did.
Yeah.
Now, when you finished your courses, you were a second lieutenant, you got your commission, and you had awesome responsibility now as a second Louis, and so your commission is...
Just a second lieutenant, eh?
Yes, Alfred James...
Yeah, June 1940.
June 1940, it says active militia.
Yeah, that was because the pots passed, you see.
I see.
Yeah.
And were commissioned as a second lieutenant.
That's right.
Corps Reserves, the Royal Montreal Regiment.
That's right.
Then brackets MG, which would be machine guns.
Yeah, right.
And Athlone has signed it. That was George VI.
Yeah.
Commissioning parchment, I guess would be what it's called.
Mm-hmm. There are some people, of course, who have Edward VIII's signature on there. There's a few of them around. Have you bumped into any in your interviews?
No, only Athlone's. I've only seen Athlone's. Mm-hmm. Oh, that was pretty high. Let me just think now. How did it feel that, I mean, you've got about a year into it now. Almost a year into it. You've gone from trooper, you've gone through two regiments now. You were brought into the social, the ideological framework. And now you're commissioned. You're no longer a cadet or a trooper. Someone, you, for the first time, you're going to be given some orders and giving the...
Well, at that stage, I was in charge of the whole physical and recreational training program for the complete machine gun training center in Trois-Rivières. An awesome responsibility, I thought, for a 23-year-old kid who really didn't know a great deal about the military other than he'd picked up in the last 4 or 5 months. But as I say, living with these three experts in the one hut, I learned an awful lot from them.
You became an expert.
Exactly. Well, I hope not, but I tried to emulate what they were doing. But, to be perfectly frank with you, I had no interest whatsoever in staying there as an instructor because I want to go to the Royal Montreal Regiment, which had been in England since the late days of 1939, and here 1940 was slipping away, and in those days you never knew when the war was going to start or end, or, you know, the phony war had been on and over, and you said, Lord, what am I doing sitting here training these troops for? I should be with my regiment. So you used to spend most of your time lobbying with the adjutant or anybody you could to get on a draft to go overseas and join your regiment. That was the big thing. You spend an awful lot of time working, but you spend a lot of time lobbying too, just to see if you can get out of the damn place. And I must say, I was in a center that was perfectly happy, well administered, and as I said earlier on, with D. Stuart Forbes, the idea man as the boss, which made it fun to work with. And,
well, this is the screwball that had the fall ball retrieval.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
He was a genius. He was a genius. A mad genius. And he was the most attractive man because he had been hit by a bullet in World War I, and it cut him from the end of his lip right up through his cheek. And it used to have a tremendous deep scar on him. And I remember the troops used to say, he had an MC from the war, and they used to say, these short forms, MC and scar. But this beautiful scar, it looked like a Heidelberg Julie scar. But as I say, one. And I said, some of the people there, George Grimson, who was the bursar at McGill, was the adjutant. T. Miles Gordon, who was an instructor in history, a professor of history at McGill, was the administrative officer, or vice versa. Grimson was the administrative officer, he was the adjutant. These were top-notch people, a lot of them from McGill, of course, because of D. Stuart Forbes being from McGill. And that, a menage of people of that stature in the community, along with these ex-permanent force senior warrant officers who had been commissioned, gave you a melange parfait. It was just the perfect mix. And I enjoyed it there, but as I say, like any other young officer, you don't want to sit on your butt training people, you want to go and join your regiment.
You've got to get that promotion, you've got to command the battalion. What did he say?
I don't know, I never had stars in my eyes, and I used to think I was damn lucky to make second lieutenant.
Well, I was wondering about ambition now, I mean, because you had gone from trooper to commissioned ranks, and did you see yourself commanding your battalion in the field?
Not the slightest.
No?
I'd love to have had a troop, because you see, when we were for us, platoon. I've got to get rid of that cavalry term here. I'm talking about infantry. Yeah. When we were, although we were instructors for ceremonial parades and inspections and so forth, you also had a troop of men to look after, or platoon of men. And I must say this was enjoyable. You can't play scoutmaster to Canadian soldiers. You know, these people go around and say you got to inspect their feet every night and this sort of nonsense. Canadian soldiers don't go for that. There is a rapport you can work with, up with 30 men, and they know how far they can go, and they know how far you will go, and you can get a troop and your platoon and get it really organized. And I had one in Valcartier, no, in Trois-Rivières. And I was terribly proud of that. And I said, now, why can't I be doing this sort of thing all the time over in England with my regiment? Why am I going to be doing it here? And that was about the zenith of my ambition, to get a platoon in the Royal Montreal Regiment at that time.
When did he go overseas?
Oh, in 41, spring of 41.
So you had to throw out the rest of the time in
Three Rivers? Oh, yes, indeed. And, well, not all the time in Three Rivers. I don't know whether I mentioned earlier on this Canadian Army Mobile Demonstration Unit. Well, I got jailed for that, and we got 30 men, all about 6 foot tall, all well-trained athletes, and we put on a show.
A show.
Yeah, exactly.
For the folks.
Yeah, a show for the folks. And, we did machine gun attacks. We had a couple of old Mark IV tanks by this time, whatever they were called, the ones that old Worthy had stolen from the Americans, and we had them operating so we could put on a show, and lots of pyrotechnics and lots of bangs and noise and so forth. And the idea was to show what the Canadian Army looked like. I enjoyed that. I did that for 3 or 4 months. Toured all over Quebec and Ontario, played the Toronto Exhibition, the Central Exhibition in Ottawa.
It felt like a hoot.
Oh, exactly. I felt like as though I was in a touring troupe of,
You should talk with it.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, we used to put on boxing exhibitions, you know, showing the way boxing is taught to the troops and this sort of thing. I enjoyed it. But I was saying all the time, why can't I be with my regiment?
Yeah, but I guess your training there would probably be better, you'd be better prepared after this type of thing? Or
actually, not? Having met up with chaps who were in the regiment during that period, said it was most boring. But that isn't what it appeared to you. At a distance, that was the epitome. That was the goal. Get over there, get a platoon in your regiment and work with them. I imagine that maybe from the point of view of the war effort, I did more good what I was doing here, but I could never saw it that way at the time, let me tell you. No.
When you finish your circus act of physical fitness, then I'm sorry.
That's a very good term.
Unfair.
No, that's a good term.
Which, of course, is like showing the flag, showing the army, encouraging, the home morale. When you're finished this and that, your lobbying paid off, I assume. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, the regiment called for a draft to come. But you have to realize the system. There was a thing called a machine gun holding unit in England. And if you were in the Toronto Scottish Regiment, the Royal Montreal Regiment, the Saskatoon Light Infantry, the Cameron Highlanders of Ottawa, they called the people forward, to fill the slots in the holding unit. And then, in turn, the regiments drew them from the holding unit as
from
the title.
The
exactly. Yeah. But you generally got to your own regiment. In other words, you went there wearing Royal Montreal or Saskatoon Light Infantry, etc., badges, and you were usually drawn by your regiment from that pool that they had in the holding unit. And of course, once you get yourself branded as a jock, as I was by this time, immediately I got into the holding unit in England in 1941. What happens to me? I become the sports officer, first of all for the holding unit, and then the sports and recreation officer for what was called Don Group, all the group of holding units in the Aldershot Command. So the only difference was the change in locale. I was doing the same job, practically. And this time, no troop of my own, or no platoon of my own.
No. When you made the draft, do you recall how you went overseas?
Yes, I remember it very well, because it was on again, off again. I don't know how many times, you'd have to ask my bride, how many times we said goodbye. And then, no. You were warned for draft. The draft was canceled. This went on month after month. And then eventually we left, and I remember the station platform in Trois-Rivières and getting on the train and going to Halifax and the band playing in the quay side at Halifax, which I thought was very nice, but very bad for security. And then we got on board the Warwick Castle, one of the old Castle Line boats, and we sailed across.
Very crowded,
but as by this time we were full lieutenant, so we were, I think, 8 to a one-room cabin.
Lots of luxury.
I might say not a hell of a lot better when I came back from the war as a lieutenant colonel. And actually, the meals were still very, very good in the Castle Line. It had been in the passenger service, of course, and of course, immediately I got on board. I don't volunteer for things, but I usually end up with silly jobs. I got the job from the ship's officers, or the conducting officer, as sports and recreation officer on board ship. So I spent most of my time on organizing small games and PT parades and so forth. Rather fun, because the nursing sisters of the 6th Casualty Clearing Station were on board. So I had to give them their physical training every morning, as well as the men. It was a very, very interesting job. Also, because I had been a machine gun expert, and it was a DEMS, as they call them, defensively equipped merchant ship. They had, no, that's not right, because it wasn't a merchant ship, it was a passenger ship, but the same kind of thing. They had Marlins and Hispano-Suizas were the two guns on them. And strangely enough,
Hispano-Suizas?
Yeah.
There was an engine in a car.
Oh, yes, but they also made an extremely sophisticated. I think it was a 0.5, I'm not quite sure. But the reason that all these things build up one on top of the other, when I'd been studying the Lewis gun and the Vickers gun, I picked up some old manuals on others, the Marlin and the Hispano-Suiza amongst them. Of course, they had a DEMS officer on board, but he needed an assistant, so in addition to getting the sports officer's job, I became his assistant, and stripping the guns and making sure that they're properly oiled and so forth. We never had to use them, thank goodness, but it was an interesting thing.
Now, would you go over alone or in convoy?
We went in convoy, and of course, like in all convoys, there's all sorts of rumors. We're being hunted by submarines, and there was one behind us and one in front of us, but not a damn thing happened. Not a thing.
Nothing at all.
No. We arrived in Liverpool, and then we went our various ways, because there's a lot of people on board, of course. I think we were a group of 10 machine gun sultans. The rest of them were formed units in some cases, like the casualty clearing station. And we went from Liverpool, and of course we first went into Aldershot Command, into the machine gun holding units. I told you I ended up sports officer there. And then eventually got to my regiment.
What did you think of England when you first got there?
Oh, I enjoyed it.
Did we have Battle of Britain going on?
No, it was over by that time.
Yeah.
There was lots of tip and run raids in the areas we were in, and we lost a few men, you know, to bombing attacks, and we had bombs all around us.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is that the bullets are flying now.
Yeah.
This is the real, real McCoy, as opposed to the theory.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a change in attitude on your part, do you think, when you got there?
I was perpetually nervous. I'm not a particularly brave person, and I used to feel a little apprehensive, especially when we had jobs to do down the seacoast, as we did from time to time. It was a bit off-putting.
But you would come down, I'm just thinking what you would see out the train, I guess, and getting into Aldershot, and just the general atmosphere of the place. Did you feel at home? Did it feel strange country?
Not particularly, and of course we went to a barracks that had been built at the time of the Crimean War, I think, and it was just, it was getting on into the fall again, and we got one piece of coal a day or whatever it was, and it was very cold, and the mess was very barren. It wasn't very. Then they moved us. They moved the machine gun holding unit from that barracks to one called Crookham Crossroads. It's called Leipzig Barracks, and it had been the Royal horse artillery had been at, a unit of the Royal Horse Artillery, and we found that a little more congenial because it was a smaller, it was a not a very good building, but we had a nice mess there. We had very good quartermaster, good messing officer, and therefore the men were better fed than they had been in the other places that we had been in England. Extremely good quartermaster. In fact, the father of a serving lieutenant general now was our quartermaster, Jim Quinn's dad. And
this would be approximately May 41.
No, it'd be in the going into the summer.
Later
on. And all that time, and then as I say, from June until 42, when I went up and joined the regiment. But I enjoyed that work. We did other things besides training. There was a thing called Maple Force, which was an anti-invasion force, and I was a liaison officer for that. And one of my jobs was to learn all the routes from where we were in Crookham Crossroads down to the various places where there might be an invasion of the island. And that gave me sort of carte blanche to spend hours on a old Norton motorcycle looking around the countryside, which I found it beautiful. I used to know every pub between Aldershot Command and the South Coast.
What about, were you given immediate leave in London, do you recall?
Oh, yes. I think we got debarkation leave immediately we got there, but I didn't go to London. I went to Edinburgh. My wife, although she was born in Canada, is of Scottish parentage, and she went to school in Edinburgh, and she still had her old granny up there, and I went to see her in my first leave, which I enjoyed. I went on the what was left of the Royal Scot or the Flying Scotsman or whatever it was. It wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to be, but then again, whatever is, trains.
Nothing what it once was. No. Well, sir, I know you have a golf engagement and then other activities. We've got a very good start today, and if I can come back and see you again.
I'm yours to command anytime. I've got quite a few things to do, but I'll be delighted to give you any time you need.
Thank you very much, sir.